From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we speak with writer Amos Oz about growing up in Jerusalem in the 1940s and 50s, just before and after the creation of the State of Israel. He writes about this time of his life in his new book, A Tale of Love and Darkness. His parents had fled to Jerusalem from Eastern Europe. Oz is Israel's most popular and critically acclaimed writer. He also co-founded the Peace Now movement in 1977. Also, rock historian Ed Ward recalls the mid-career of Little Richard when he briefly turned to gospel music before making secular records again. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush spoke today in the Canadian city of Halifax, where he thanked people for helping passengers on international flights who were stranded on September 11th. And the president also acknowledged Canada's opposition to the Iraq War, but said that Canadians and Americans will always be close.
Beyond the words of politicians and the natural disagreements that nations will have, our two peoples are one family and always will be.
U.S. military officials say they're temporarily expanding the force in Iraq by some 12,000 troops ahead of Iraqi elections scheduled for January 30th. The boost would put the U.S. force at about 150,000 through the election. NPR's Eric Westerveld has more from the Pentagon.
Two army brigades, or about 8,000 soldiers, will have their lengthy combat tours extended by 2 months. 2,300 Marines will also be extended in Iraq. For the 2nd Brigade of the Army's 1st Cavalry Division, this is the second extension in Iraq, and it will keep the unit there until March. In addition, a battalion of the Army's 82nd Airborne Division will be deployed to Iraq for up to 120 days. Military commanders say the measures are intended to, quote, keep the insurgents off balance after Fallujah and set the conditions for successful Iraqi elections. Analysts say the extensions also highlight the potency of the Iraqi insurgency and the continued inadequacy of U.S.-trained Iraqi security forces. Eric Westerveld, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Ukraine's parliament narrowly voted today to dismiss the government of Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych because of allegations that it rigged the results of last month's presidential election. Yanukovych refuses to recognize the parliament's decision. The no-confidence vote is not going down well in eastern Ukraine, where Yanukovych has strong support. Politicians in one eastern region are moving ahead with efforts to get more autonomy. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Donetsk.
The electronic clock in the Donetsk regional parliament counted down for a vote on whether to hold a referendum on turning Ukraine into a federation. Deputies overwhelmingly voted yes and set January 9th as referendum day. This is the first formal step toward more autonomy for eastern Ukraine. It's heavily watered down from calls for independence or uniting with Russia that eastern Ukrainian leaders were making just a few days ago. Some here say if the political crisis in the country is resolved in a way acceptable to the East, the interest in greater autonomy will slow. But the national parliament's decision to effectively fire the prime minister is not seen as a step forward here. Emily Harris, NPR News, Donetsk.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 162 points, or more than 1.5%, to close at 10,590. The Nasdaq was up 41 to 2138. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon lost an important vote in parliament when members of his own coalition voted against him. Sharon responded by firing cabinet ministers after the vote. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
By a large majority of 69 to 43, the first reading of Israel's budget failed to pass parliament. After the vote, Sharon fired the four cabinet ministers from the centrist Shinui party. With the Shinui party out, Sharon's coalition has just 40 of the 120 members of parliament. Two other parties had already left the government over Sharon's plan for a unilateral pullback from Gaza. Israeli analysts said the vote on the budget was expected, but the size of the majority against it was larger than expected. Aides to the prime minister say he will now try to convince the Labour Party to join the coalition. If Sharon is unable to pass the budget by March 31st, the government falls and new elections will be held. Linda Gradstein, NPR News. Jerusalem.
Two of the major television networks have refused to broadcast a TV commercial for the United Church of Christ, saying its message of inclusion is too controversial. NBC and CBS turned down the commercial, which promotes the church's openness to all sorts of people, including homosexuals. According to a statement from the United Church of Christ, CBS declined to air the ad with the statement, quote, "The executive branch has recently proposed a constitutional amendment to define marriage as the union between a man and a woman." ABC also rejected the ad, saying it's against network policy to air commercials for religious organizations. Other networks will show the ad, including Discovery, TNT, and Fox. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, giving back to communities by supporting beneficial and charitable initiatives at the local and national level. On the web at walmartfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Israel's most acclaimed novelist, Amos Oz, has written a new book about growing up in Jerusalem in the 1940s and 50s, in the shadow of the Holocaust and in fear of Arab attack. His parents had fled Eastern Europe in the early 30s. In telling his own story, he describes some of the larger issues that faced Jews just before and after the State of Israel was created. He also describes life on the kibbutz that he lived in after leaving home at the age of 15 in 1954. He stayed there through 1986 when he moved to a town in the Negev Desert where the climate was preferable for his son's asthma. Oz's new book is called A Tale of Love and Darkness. Although it's subtitled A Memoir, Oz says some of the stories he tells about his parents' and grandparents' lives are based not just on fact and memory, but on considerable speculation. His book has become one of the biggest-selling literary works in Israeli history. Oz is also known for his work as a peace activist and a proponent of a two-state solution. He co-founded the Peace Now movement in 1977. Why did your parents move to Israel in 1933?
Well, presenting the question this way suggests that they went to their travel agency and looked for a country where to live. In fact, there was no travel agency for the Jews in the late 1930s. They were virtually kicked out of Europe by violent anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe and the rising of Nazism in Central Europe. No other country wanted them at that time. There was no kind of list of choices. It's not that they should have opted for the French Riviera and by mistake they opted for Jerusalem. They were kicked out of Europe and Jerusalem in this time, the land of Israel at that time, was the only available life raft when no other country wanted them. They did try. Some members of my family tried to apply for a French, an American, a Scandinavian, a British, even a German citizenship, and they were turned down by everybody.
I think, you know, a lot of Jewish people who grew up in, say, the 1950s and whose grandparents emigrated closer to the turn of the century, emigrated to America from Eastern Europe, you know, fleeing the pogroms, these grandparents often didn't want to talk about the, quote, old country. They were, for whatever reasons, whether it was painful memories or the pain of having to leave home and leave family behind, a lot of grandparents just wouldn't talk about it. Now, your parents loved the Europe they left behind, not loved the persecution, but missed that Europe. Did they talk to you much about it?
Never. They censored it the same way people censor an unrequited love from their children. You don't discuss with your child someone who dumped you when you were younger, someone whom you loved and dumped you. And that's exactly how they felt about Europe. Their house was full of syndromes and signs and clues for their heartbroken love for Europe, but they never talked about it, except very indirectly. My father used to say from time to time that one day, not in his lifetime, maybe in my lifetime, our Jerusalem will evolve and develop into a real city. I couldn't understand what he was talking about. For me, Jerusalem was the only real city in the world. Even Tel Aviv was a myth. Over the years, I learned that when my father expressed the word, pronounced the words, a real city, he meant a city with a river in the middle, bridges across the river, and dense forests round about. Europe, the promised land from the promised land.
How did your parents describe the meaning of Israel to you when you were growing up?
Well, in the 1940s, Israel was still a dream, a vision, and a blueprint. They talked about the impending creation of a Jewish state in messianic terms. This state, which is about to be born, will be pure, angelic, idyllic. It will hold world records in high jump morality, gold medal in good behavior, in treating minorities, in social justice. It will be both biblical and modern, both very Jewish and very secular and very democratic and very socialistic. It will be more everything than anyone. But this, of course, was a dream, a fantasy, a vision. And then came the morning after.
And?
Well, the morning after is a disappointment by definition. I maintain that the only way to keep a dream, not only a Zionist dream, any dream, a sexual fantasy, the only way to keep any dream or fantasy intact and rosy and perfect and flawless is never to try to live it out. Israel is a dream come true. As such, it is destined to be a disappointment to some extent. And I accept it philosophically. I am glad it is a fulfilled dream, and I'm aware of it, that some of the initial visions and expectations and desires and ambitions of the founding fathers and mothers could never materialize. They were meta-human. They were impossible to materialize.
Your father had utopian hopes for the future of Israel, but he was not a religious man. You're right, he considered the priests of every faith as rather suspect, ignorant men who fostered antique hatreds. He suspected everyone who made a living from religion of some kind of sugared charlatanism, but he did believe in a vague providence, a residing spirit of the people. He believed in the wonders of the, quote, creative Jewish genius. Can you talk a little bit about your parents' sense of what it meant to them to be Jewish?
Well, both of them were secular. None of them was a synagogue goer. Even my grandparents were very secular. I am at least a third generation of secularized Jews, for whom being Jewish is first and foremost a sense of cultural belonging, not a synagogual belonging. Judaism to me is a culture, first and foremost the Hebrew language, which I think is the crux of the heritage, a long line of books, creations, certain sensibilities which I identify as Jewish sensibilities, although they are not exclusively Jewish, humor and skepticism, certain anarchism, certain lack of confidence in any regime or government whatsoever, certain utopian ambitions about world reforming. All of this I identify, this and more, I identify as Jewish heritage, Jewish sensibilities, and all of those are alive and kicking, somehow, sometimes kicking too hard, outside the realm of synagogue.
Now you describe the Hebrew language as being at the crux of the Israeli heritage or the Jewish heritage. What languages did your parents speak to each other and to you in?
Now, here's a comedy. They would speak between them Russian and Polish for me not to understand. 95% of the time they wanted me not to understand what they were speaking about because they were talking either about the mass murder of their relatives in Europe by the Nazis or about the disaster, the calamity, the mass murder which may happen in Jerusalem once the British pull out and the Arab nations will smash us. So this was not for the kid. This was Polish and Russian. They read books in German, French, and English for culture. I believe they dreamt their dreams in Yiddish, but me they taught Hebrew and only Hebrew as a precaution. They feared that if I had one European language, I would eventually be seduced by the deadly charms of Europe. I'll go to Europe and catch my death. So they did not want me to know any European language for my own safety. And so it happened that the very first English words I ever learned to pronounce were the words British go home, which is what we Jewish kids used to shout as we were throwing stones at the British patrols in Jerusalem in 1946-47 in what should be regarded really as the first original intifada in Jerusalem, the Jewish intifada against the British, talking about ironies of history.
Did your parents know Hebrew before they moved to Israel?
Oh, yes, they both had a Hebraic upbringing in secular Zionist schools in Ukraine and Lithuania, respectively. Yes.
Now, you talked about how your parents spoke in the languages of their countries to protect you from the subjects that they were talking about when they were talking about the pogroms in Europe or the Holocaust in Germany. What were some of the fears that you grew up with living in Israel during the Holocaust?
In the 1940s, I grew up in the shadow of an unpronounced horror. And the horror was that which was happening to the Jews in Europe, mass murder by the Nazis, is going to repeat itself in Jerusalem, either because the Nazi panzers, armed columns, will conquer Palestine and put all the Jews in gas chambers, or else because the British will eventually pull out and leave the small Jewish community in the land of Israel to the mercy of the entire merciless Arab world. So we feared a mass murder of our own community the same way it happened to the Jewish communities all over Europe in the 40s.
Did you live in a state of fear? Did you have a lot of nightmares?
That was a subterranean fear. You have to imagine a city under siege. You have to imagine a town where British curfew used to be imposed at 7 p.m. almost every night. You have to imagine a city where the Jewish underground terrorist groups blew up British military installations almost every night. You have to imagine a Jewish Jerusalem surrounded by Arabs, towns and villages, most of them very hostile. You have to imagine the insecurity of the days and of the nights, and you have to bear in mind that everyone was a refugee from some inferno or another, not only from Europe. There were those who were kicked out of the Arab and Islamic countries, those who survived by the skin of their teeth, the Arab and Islamic hatred for Jews, and they also came to the land of Israel. So, as I often say, Israel is essentially a refugee camp. So is Palestine, which is what makes this conflict so tragic. It's a tragic conflict between two victims, between two refugee camps.
My guest is Amos Oz. His new book is called A Tale of Love and Darkness. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Amos Oz, and his new book is part novel, part memoir, about growing up in Israel and about his parents' and grandparents' lives. What was it like for you watching Holocaust survivors come to Israel and seeing the state that they were in and just sensing what they had lived through, what they had narrowly survived?
Well, I am ashamed to tell you, but I did tell this in A Tale of Love and Darkness, so I have to repeat it in this interview. We looked down at those survivors. We thought of them as sissy, weak people, while we Israeli Jews fought back, repelled the enemies, practiced with submachine guns, even in times of the British Mandate as part of an illicit defense force. They went, quote-unquote, like sheep to the slaughter. It took me years to understand what an idiot I was in looking down at those Holocaust survivors for not fighting back. How could they fight back? Who on earth could fight back the Nazi machine when you have no country, no allies, no weapons, no chance in hell to defend yourself? So yes, I'm ashamed to confess that we were patronizing the Holocaust survivors, and we were saying to them, we native Israelis, we were saying to them, wait, we will teach you how to be proud, how to be strong, how to fight back, how to get suntanned.
Was that the general attitude?
Quite widespread. But then it's not unusual for Israelis to look down at each other from different angles.
when Britain decided to end its rule in Palestine, and then fighting broke out between Israelis and Arabs, part of Jerusalem was under siege and cut off from the rest of the country. What was it like for you to be a boy caught in that?
Jewish Jerusalem was under siege for several months, starved, cut off from the water supply, and heavily bombarded by the regular artillery of the Transjordanian army and for a while also by the Egyptian army from the south. Of course, in my head, I was the prime minister. I was the general in chief. I commanded the battlefield on a mat in the corridor. But actually, we lived like moles behind sandbags in the basement, hungry, thirsty, dirty, terrified to death, because in our heart of hearts, we did not really believe the Jews were going to win that war. And in our heart of hearts, at least in this part of the country, in Jewish Jerusalem, which was very much like an East European shtetl, we feared that the Jews will lose the war and will be eradicated, slaughtered, the same way they were slaughtered by their enemies in Europe. So I remember those months of the siege with pain and anger and frustration, and yet with a special tenderness about how my father and mother, two not very strong people in any way, how, in the last analysis, courageous and decent they were.
Did they try to prepare you for the worst?
Indirectly, yes. They said, some of the grown-ups will say, enjoy your life, kid. You know, not every kid grows up to become a person, which is why I developed the fantasy of growing up and becoming a book. Not a novelist, but a book. I knew how easy it is to kill people. I knew it was very easy to kill authors. I knew it was very easy to burn books. But books are stubborn. Some godforsaken copy may survive in a faraway library somewhere in Iceland or in Paraguay or in Australia. So it would have been safest to grow up and become a book, not an author, but a book. That was one of my childhood's fantasies. And this fantasy is a result of deep insecurity.
And also, I think the fantasy is a result of the fact that you grew up around books. And wasn't your father a librarian?
Oh, he was a librarian, but he was more than that. He was bookish. Everyone was bookish.
What are your memories of Israel's Independence Day? You write that your father told you to take it all in because this is something you'd be talking about to your children, to your grandchildren.
Yes, this was a euphoric night for me. I was about 9 years old when the General Assembly of the United Nations, then in Lake Success, resolved by a two-thirds vote to divide Palestine into two sovereign states, Palestinian Arab state and Israeli Jewish state. This, in brackets, is going to be the bottom line of several decades of conflict. In the end, Israelis and Palestinians will come back to a two-state solution. Close brackets. Now, for me, that night is a memory which I will carry for the rest of my life. Never in my life, either before or after, have I seen such a burst of public euphoria. Euphoria combined with fear of the future. No one was certain of the results. No one was certain whether we are going to survive the impending battle with the Arab world. But this euphoria that the Jews will become an independent nation for the first time in 19 centuries, since the eradication of ancient Israel by the Roman armies, by the Roman Empire, that once again there will be a Jewish regime, a Jewish government, a Jewish law, a Jewish sovereignty. The kind of vindication of people who have always been an oppressed and loathed minority, wherever, everywhere, except perhaps in the United States of America, but everywhere else, the feeling that at last we are going to have a home. It may be very small. It may be a home the size of a handkerchief or a postal stamp on the map of the world, but nonetheless, it's going to be our home. This euphoria of that night, the singing, the dancing in the street, the hugging between total strangers, the tears, the vows, this I'll never forget, just as I will not forget the deep sad silence which dawned on the Arab neighborhoods. Our joy was their catastrophe, their fear and trembling and despair and anger and bewilderment. I will never forget how, while half Jerusalem celebrated with fireworks and singing and dancing, the other parts of Jerusalem were wrapped in darkness, silence, and sadness.
What did you know Arab children at that time? Did you have any Arab friends or acquaintances?
Yes, I did have some. It was not an everyday thing for a Jewish kid to go to the Arab neighborhoods. Tension existed even before the creation of the State of Israel and even before the much-condemned Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. There was tension, hatred, and violence. One or two, I would say, short stories within the tale. I recollect some of my encounters with Palestinian people and Palestinian children. One of two of them, or two of them, were quite disastrous.
Disastrous in what way?
Well, at the age of 9, I tried to impress in a very immature, machoistic way a 12-year-old Palestinian femme fatale. She was 12, I was 9. I wanted to show off. I climbed a tree and unintentionally caused an accident in which her little brother was injured. I meant well. I meant to show off. I meant to prove to her that some Jews are Tarzans, they can climb trees. I meant to show her that I am the new type of a Jew, I am the physical Jew, which I was not and I am not. But that's the impression I wanted to project on this 12-year-old little seducer. So it ended up in a fiasco and in pain and in injury.
I want to pick up on something that you just said, you know, that you wanted to prove that you were a different kind of Jew. You were a physical Jew, which you are not. What did that mean to you to try to prove that you were this different kind of Jew, physical?
Part of the ethos of early Israel was we have to be born again. If the whole world hates us Jews for being talkative, intellectual, bookish, full of ideas, but not very physical. All of us have to be born again into a nation of silent, tough, strong tractor drivers and soldiers who fight back and punch back twice as hard when necessary, who plow the land, shut up, and don't read too many books and don't talk too much.
Amos Oz, his new book is called A Tale of Love and Darkness. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of poems and tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA Craft, providing a wide selection of individual retirement solutions, tiaacraft.org/radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Amos Oz talks about his mother's suicide when he was 12. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back on the records Little Richard made in the mid-60s after his big hits. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Amos Oz, Israel's most popular and internationally acclaimed writer. He also co-founded the Peace Now movement in 1977 and remains an advocate of a two-state solution. His new book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, tells the story of his boyhood in Jerusalem just before and after the creation of the State of Israel. His parents fled to Jerusalem from Eastern Europe in the early 30s. Oz was born in 1939. This is the first time you've written about your mother's suicide. She was, I think, 38 when she died. You were about 12 and a half. You say she'd never really taken to life in Israel. Why not?
I think her years in Jerusalem felt like exile for her. She didn't like the climate. She didn't like the atmosphere. She didn't like the company. And she was forever grieving for her hometown in the Ukraine, which she had to leave because anti-Semitism became unbearable. But many of her Jewish and non-Jewish friends were left there behind, in fact, most of them. And the non-Jewish friends were involved in killing the Jewish friends once the Nazis conquered this township of Rovno, where 25,000 Jews were shot dead in 2 days. You know, 25,000 Jews is more than the overall number of Jews who died in 100 years of conflict with the Arabs. 25,000 people, a whole town in 2 days. For my mother, this was an everlasting trauma. Add to this the dreariness of a rather pedestrian marriage. Add to this unfulfilled artistic ambitions or yearnings. Add to this a certain intellectual and emotional finesse for which Jerusalem of the 40s was just the wrong place. And you end up with sadness, loneliness, despair, desolation, and longing.
We should also add the migraines and insomnia.
Well, they were the result of it. It's not the migraines and the insomnia that caused her sadness. It's her sadness and desperation that caused, I think, the insomnia and the migraines. However, A Tale of Love and Darkness is very much written with the ambition to resolve an enigma. How could the marriage between two kind, gentle, well-meaning, civilized people end with such a colossal tragedy? How can good plus good produce tragedy? This was the enigma that set me writing, not the birth of Israel, not the significance of the Jewish state. The enigma of how can two very good people cause such a disaster together. Now I have a confession to make. In the course of writing, I lost interest in solving the enigma. If any of my readers hope to find, after more than 500 pages, in the last page, who was the murderer, don't read my book. If any of my readers hope to find in the end of the book who was the good guy and who was the bad guy, don't read my book. I found more and more empathy in me for both of them, for my mother's sadness, despair, and loneliness, and for my father, my kind, gentle father's inability to help her, hard as he tried, and my own inability to save her.
Do you think that the problem too might have been beyond the marriage? It might have been that she was just given to depression.
That would be too simplistic. I mean, this would be the kind professional definition of her condition, perhaps. Depression is such a vague and wide term covering so many things. Whereas in A Tale of Love and Darkness, I wanted to describe in great detail what is behind her specific, personal, one woman's depression, namely the desolation, the unfulfilled dreams, the yearnings, the mourning for the dead, alienness she felt in Jerusalem.
How did she kill herself?
She swallowed an overdose of medicines indiscriminately, all the medicines she could find in her sister's home where she went for a weekend. She went there because, I presume, she wanted to die away from home and away from her 12-year-old son, to spare me the sight. She had many different sleeping pills prescribed by over-devoted bunch of doctors. She had a variety of medicines, this and that. She swallowed everything, fell asleep, and never woke up.
In your book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, you write about your reaction when you were 12 to your mother's suicide. And I'd like you to read a passage from that description.
I was angry with her for leaving without saying goodbye, without a hug, without a word of explanation. After all, my mother had been incapable of parting even from a total stranger, a delivery man or a peddler, at the door without offering him a glass of water, without a smile, without a little apology and two or three pleasant words. All through my childhood, she had never left me alone at the grocer's or in a strange courtyard or in a public garden. How could she have done it? I was angry with her on father's behalf too, whose wife had shamed him thus, had shown him up, had suddenly vanished like a woman running away with a stranger in a comic film. Throughout my childhood, if I ever disappeared, even for an hour or two, I was shouted at and punished. It was a fixed rule that anyone who went out always had to say where they were going and for how long and what time they would be back. At least they had to leave a note in the usual place under the vase. All of us. Is that the way to live, rudely, in the middle of a sentence? She herself had always insisted on fact, politeness, considerate behavior, a constant effort not to hurt others, attentiveness, sensitivity. How could she? I hated her.
You write in your book that after going through a period of being really angry at your mother, you went through a period of being really angry at yourself and blaming yourself for what happened.
Well, I lived in a vicious circle for many years. I hated her for walking away on me. I hated my father for losing such a wonderful wife. And I hated myself, thinking that if I only behaved myself, if I was better at school, if I would really wash behind my ears every evening without cheating, she would still be there. I thought there must be something terribly wrong with little me, or else she wouldn't walk away on me. So there was a cycle of anger, hatred, resentment, and silence, which is why for many years I never discussed her death with anyone, never with my father until his dying day, never. Never with my wife and children. It was only after many years that I could view things with a different perspective. And the anger and the insult and the wrath gave way to curiosity, compassion, humor, irony, and warmth. I could only write about my mother's death, my parents' tragedy. When I reached the age where I could view my parents as if they were my children, where I could write about my grandparents as if they were my grandchildren, with a parently compassion and parently smile at their follies, at their short-sightedness, at their inability to conduct a marriage, although they were both very kind, very gentle, and very devoted to one another.
My guest is Amos Oz. His new book is called A Tale of Love and Darkness. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Israel's most popular and internationally acclaimed writer, Amos Oz. His new book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, is about growing up in Jerusalem. When we left off, we were talking about his mother's suicide when he was 12. There is an element of mystery here. I mean, you print a letter that you got later from one of your mother's friends, and the letter said, "If you only knew how much your mother wanted to be an artist, to be a creative person from her childhood, if only she could see you now, and why didn't she manage it? Maybe in a personal conversation I could be more daring and tell you things that I don't dare put in writing." What do you think that was?
Well, I think it was her deep disappointment from the fading away of life. She grew up with an intensely romantic menu. In this menu, she was supposed to grow up into a pianist or maybe a poet. She was expecting to grow up in an artistic milieu, in a peaceful country, in a civilized society, in a Central European cultured atmosphere. She found herself housewifing, trapped in poverty, lower middle class, insecurity, in sun-scorched, hot, dusty, fanatic Jerusalem. I know this now because as I wrote A Tale of Love and Darkness, I actually invited all those dead people to my home for a cup of coffee and a cake. I said to my mother and my father and my grandparents and half the neighborhood, all of those who are dead now, I said, sit down, have a coffee, have a cake, let us talk. We have never talked when you were alive, not on things that mattered, not on emotions, certainly not about sensuality and sexuality, not about shattered dreams, not about your unrequited love for Europe. Let's talk now. And I talked to the dead, and after talking, I said, I want to introduce you to my wife and children. They have never met you. You have never met them. It's just as well that you meet. And then after this session, I said to the dead, now go away. You're not going to live in my house. You may drop by from time to time for coffee. That's the mode in which I wrote A Tale of Love and Darkness, not to score my accounts with them, not to punish them, not to get back at them, not to show to the world that the fact that I am imperfect is to be blamed on my unhappy childhood or my terrible parents. Not at all. It's a book of compassion and forgiveness.
Is the letter that I quoted a real letter that you got?
Yes.
Now, at age 15, you left home. This was a couple of years after your mother's suicide. You left home and moved to a kibbutz against your father's will. You quote your father as saying, the kibbutz may be a not insignificant phenomenon, but it requires manual workers of average intelligence. You know by now that you are decidedly not average. You will not be able to develop there. Consequently, I'm afraid I cannot agree to this in any way, and that's that. End of discussion. Did you worry about this, too, that manual labor wasn't about who you were and that it wouldn't be a place in which you could develop intellectually?
I rebelled. I decided to be born anew. It's not only that I decided not to be what my father wanted me to be. I decided not to be what I really was. I decided to change my name from Klausner to Oz. I decided to get suntanned in 2 weeks. I decided to get strong, tall, muscular, good-looking, silent, and very impressive to the girls. It cut a lot of ice for me, you know, those self-changing. I'm very ironical in The Tale of Love and Darkness about this whole aspiration of being born again and starting a fresh new leaf and start a new life and change yourself completely. I know there is no way.
Now, paradoxically, you go to the kibbutz to recreate yourself and to kind of tone down the more, you know, intellectual part of yourself and tone up the more physical part of yourself. But you end up staying at the kibbutz from 1954 to 1985. Clearly you found a real home for yourself there. And is it fair to say you developed into a writer there?
Indeed. Kibbutz Hulda has been my home and my good home for decades. It was not only home, it was the best university I could ever hope to attend in this world. Because living in a small, tight community, very gossipy, where there are very few secrets, where I had the chance to know who cheats on whom, with whom, and how often, where I had the chance to see the genes at work from one generation to another, for a novelist, for a storyteller, this was the best preparation, the best university, the best education I could hope for. Of course, the penalty I was made to pay is that too many people knew too much about my private life, but this is only fair.
I've managed to spend all of our time talking about your past as described in your new book. I don't want to let you go without squeezing in one or two questions about the present. You co-founded Peace Now in 1978, and you've been an advocate of a two-state solution for years and an advocate of the point of view that the Israelis and the Palestinians represent two oppressed people who are both in the right and they must come up with a way of compromising. Yasser Arafat has died. There are elections in January for a new president of the Palestinian Authority. Do you think that things might change with new leadership in the Palestinians?
It's no secret that Yasser Arafat was not my hero. It's no secret that Ariel Sharon is not my hero. I think both the Palestinians and the Israelis deserve a more pragmatic, more compassionate, more imaginative leadership, and I hope this is impending on both sides.
So you think things aren't going to change, really, with Sharon in power?
You know, I'm not a political analyst, but let me give you some good tidings, because you hear the bad news all the time. Let me be the bearer of good tidings. The vast majority of the Israeli Jews and the vast majority of the Palestinian Arabs know now that in the end of the day there is going to be a two-state solution. Even individuals on both sides who reject and object this solution know that it is impending. And this is not my gut feeling. These are the findings of public opinion surveys both in Israel and in Palestine week after week after week for a long time now. The parties know what's going to happen. People do know that the country will have to be divided, that the house will have to be divided into two smaller apartments. Whether we like it or not, whether they like it or not, whether this is an aesthetic solution or not, whether this is an idyllic solution or not, it's not an idyllic solution, but it's the only pragmatic solution.
Do you think it's going to happen?
Of course it's going to happen. The only thing I cannot tell you is how soon. Because coming from the land of the prophets, it will be too risky for me to try to prophesy. There's too much competition in the prophecy business where I come from.
I know the Bush administration had said that it hoped that the war in Iraq would pave the way for democracy spreading through the middle, through that area of the world, including to the Israelis and Palestinians, you know, reaching an accord. And I'm wondering if you think that the war in Iraq has had any positive or negative impact on the Middle East.
It's a big question. I'll give you a short answer by saying that, in my view, the only power in the world which can contain fanatic Islam is modern Islam. This is true, by the way, of other fanatic movements and phenomenons. Everything that encourages and strengthens moderate Muslims is good. For the world, for the Arab world. I am not sure the war in Iraq was a reinforcement of moderation in Islam and in the Arab world.
Amos Oz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Amos Oz's new book is called A Tale of Love and Darkness. It's about growing up in Jerusalem, and it's just been published in America. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on Little Richard and the brief period mid-career when he played gospel music. This is Fresh Air. Rock historian Ed Ward ran into Little Richard earlier this year at the South by Southwest Music Festival, and that, along with Sony's reissue of some of Richard's mid-60s sessions for OK Records, got Ed thinking about Little Richard's post-hits career.
I'm going downtown about rock and tag, let my baby rock me all the way from here. She knows how to rock me. Yeah, she rock me. Well, I've ever been rocking, you know just what I mean. Well, now my baby, she's getting kind of funny. She don't want to rock till I give her my money. She knows how to rock me.
In late 1957, Little Richard was coming off of a year-long string of hits like Tutti Frutti and Long Tall Sally, but he was in turmoil. A whole galaxy of confusing things seemed to be whirling around in his head, and late that year, he quit show business during a tour of Australia, in which he proved his sincerity by taking off a ring with a huge jewel in it and tossing it into Sydney Harbor. Some said he'd been unnerved by the Soviet satellite Sputnik, imagining it whizzing above his head as he flew to Australia for this tour. Others said he'd found God and was devoting his life to the ministry. Richard himself now claims he was so appalled by the treatment he'd gotten at the hands of his record label that he was going to go to business school. Whatever the case was, She Knows How to Rock, his last record cut before the tour, is awful, a mishmash of his previous stuff, clearly the product of an artist who'd hit a dead end. But Little Richard has never exactly been a shrinking violet, and it was hard for him to stay out of the spotlight. Maybe he needed money for school, but within a few months of renouncing his career, he was in New York cutting a deal with George Goldner's End label to record a couple albums worth of gospel music.
Yes, I'm going to walk that Milky White way. Oh, child, one of these days.
One of these days.
Yes, I'm going to walk, my Lord, that Milky White way. Lord, one of these days, well, I'm gonna walk out, my Lord, taking my stand. Lord, I'm gonna join, Lord, that Christian band. That's when we walk that Milky White way. Oh, child, one of these days.
Whitebread backup singers notwithstanding, this was a whole new Little Richard. Not the religion, gospel was always part of what he did, and he clearly got his trademark falsetto cry from Professor Alex Bradford. No, Richard was actually singing. The passion of his rock and roll delivery was there, but there was less shouting and more control. These gospel sides he cut are hard to find, but they're worth seeking out. Eventually, he made up with Specialty, his old record company, and cut some old-timey sides for them with titles like Annie Is Back and Bama Lama Bama Lou. Maybe it's the stereo recording, but he sounds better here, too. The trouble is, these records were cut in 1964, hot on the heels of the Beatles, and only one of them charted, and it only made it to a humiliating number 82. Actually, Richard's heart was elsewhere, in the gospel-drenched soul he was performing on the road, backed by a band that included young Jimi Hendrix.
Treat me kind. You party all the time. You don't mean me no good. I'd leave you if only could. Baby, I don't know what you got. Honey, I don't know what you got. But it's got me. I believe it's got me. You're not very.
I don't know what you got, but it's got me did even less well than Bama Lama Bama Lou, only making it to 95 on the charts. But what a great performance it is, all 4 minutes of it. And although that may be Jimi Hendrix you hear at the beginning, more likely it's Don Covey, who wrote the song and sings those amazing harmony vocals. Jimmy's in there, though, down in the mix. In 1967, Richard latched onto what looked like a good thing. Columbia Records had reactivated its OK label for soul music, and Johnny Guitar Watson and Larry Williams were detailed to put together a house band and sign some artists for what was going to be called the Angeltown sound. While this was sort of like asking a couple of foxes to install air conditioning in the hen house, they did manage to sign Richard, and he cut two albums for them.
A little bit of something should beat a whole lot of nothing, babe. A little bit of something should beat a whole lot of nothing, baby. You better hold on to what you got. Because what you think is nothing to someone else may be a lie. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the material Larry Williams wrote for him wasn't so hot, although Richard put as much effort into it as he could, reaching some sort of weird peak with a passionate rendition of the theme song to Otto Preminger's film Hurry Sundown. The Angeltown sound was dead on delivery, although he still cut a real good live greatest hits album with the house band before the whole enterprise collapsed. It would be three more years before Richard's career was rescued by producer Richard Perry, and that's another story. But listening to these Lost Years records by one of rock and roll's originals, it's clear that the years where he made his mark only saw him using a fraction of his talent, and I wish more of the stuff he recorded during this period would come out.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The CD, Little Richard Get Down With It, The OK Sessions, was released this year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shura. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, in England, they're doing it. Oh, South America. The United States, everyone. Oh, rocket chair. Oh, yeah.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Five Men Who Broke My Heart by Susan Shapiro, a memoir about her efforts to track down the first loves of her life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the emergence of evangelical Christianity as a powerful political force. Calvin Skaggs and David Van Taylor talk about their documentary, With God on Our Side, George W. Bush and the Rise of the Religious Right. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.